Welcome back. We are joined by Stanislav Krapivnik, a former U.S. Army officer born in Donbass and who has since returned. Thank you for coming back on the program.
Always a pleasure, Glenn. Always a pleasure. But we're talking about explosions today,
Yes. Well, I appreciate you coming on. I know you had quite a few meetings and interviews today. I wanted to speak with you about U.S. boots on the ground in Iran. But before we get to that, it's worth addressing this attack on this key Russian port on the Baltic Sea. More than 1,000 kilometers away for a drone to fly from Ukraine, even further if it avoids Belarus, which it did. So yet it appears to have entered from NATO territory through the Baltic states. How do you make sense of what has happened? And what do we actually know?
Well, it didn't appear they did. In fact, two of those drones, one hit a power plant, a chimney of a power plant in Estonia, and one hit some other object in Latvia. So maybe they flew around from Ukraine through Poland and the Baltics, or maybe they lifted off from the pre-Baltics. I don't know. I'm betting closer they probably lifted off. Either way, even if they flew through, I mean, this isn't one or two drones. There's about 30, 40 drones that flew through. And this is not the first time. So either A, the Poles and the pre-Baltics are absolutely incompetent governments with incompetent security systems, that anything can fly through their airspace and they don't give a damn or cannot control it. Or B, more likely, they're in on it. They are direct military engagement with Russia at this point. Unavoidable to come to that conclusion, especially the pre-Baltics, that they are they're direct participants in this war.
Well, we see that over the past few weeks or months, NATO's, well, more or less identified the objective of putting pressure on Russia. In order to do this, they're also very explicit, that is to go after the Russian economy, energy specifically. They're discussing seizing ships, confiscating oil is the new one. But attack from NATO territory, though, how is this affecting the sentiments or the pressure in the against the Kremlin to change tactics? Because there seems to be some concern that more and more of if it's not red lines, there's overstepping more and more lines, at least, of what we're not supposed to do. I mean, there's informal rules in any proxy war, what each side should be doing, and it appears that all rules are essentially tossed overboard.
Well, this isn't the first time this has happened, let's be honest about it. 5 months ago, in the middle of Estonia, a drone came down, blew up, and Estonians tried to keep it quiet. The internet was still filled with photos that got leaked out of the shell crater where the drone hit. And it was carrying a large enough amount of explosives and the remains of that drone. The attack on Pskov Air Base did not come from Ukraine. It came from 47 kilometers away out of Estonia. I was on Evening with Vladimir Solovyov, which is one of the big shows, talk shows, political talk shows. And Vladimir himself, who is big in this, is one of the top people in this industry, is out there saying, you know, we need to crack the heads of the Estonians, just as an example. Well, I say the same thing. There needs to be an example made. And Estonia is to call it anti-Russian or Russophobic that doesn't even describe half of the psychopathic hatred that drives these people. They are corrupted through and through. Consider Russians are about 50% of their country's population. Consider Narva, which is a 95% Russian city back from the 1200s, if not earlier. You can't say these are people that are Soviet Union, but this is their excuse normally. Oh, these are immigrants from the Soviet Union forced upon us. Well, no, actually, you're holding Russian land. Get the hell off of Russian land in that case. As you know, the pre-Baltics, if we're going to go begin with this, they're three absolutely artificial countries that did not exist until 1917. In any form did they ever exist as nation states? They are an artificial entities created by the collapse of the Soviet Union, first and foremost. Well, I'm sorry, the collapse of the Russian Empire, first and foremost. And then recreated by the collapse of the Soviet Union. These, if we're going to be honest about it, the land was purchased from the Swedes after we beat Charles the Great in Poltava. Peter the Great destroyed his armies, defeated Sweden. But to make it a little easier to swallow the defeat, he paid for the land that Russia conquered from the Swedes. And in that bill, by the way, there's no mention about the population, but the land was transferred as a piece of real estate in those areas to Russia. So if we're going to go down that road, you can live here if you want, or you can leave, but the land belongs to Russia by purchase from Sweden, if we're going to go down that route. But Narva, as a city, is absolutely Russian. It's from the early Middle Ages. Was founded and created by Russians. So that almost 50% of the population of Estonia is treated as best third class non-citizens, because they're not allowed to be citizens of any sort, not even of a second class citizens. They carry a gray passport. And now you have this same Nazi entity that has yearly parades for the SS, government sponsored with government administrators coming out and talking about it. The one that arrests anybody that doesn't follow the party line, this police state Nazi entity that is now launching or allowing to be used as airspace for direct drone attacks, not just on military, but on civilian infrastructure. I think it's time that the leadership in that country paid the price that they are more than earned to pay. And look, and deterrence needs to be set. So I think a country like Estonia is the prime target for deterrence being reset. Because what they're hoping for is, no matter what they do, Russia will just hit the Ukrainians. And it's not us, it's some meat down there. They'll just kill off some meat down there, and we'll just be able to do what we want. But sooner or later, that comes home. And I think we're at that point. And out in the open, when the major television or talk show figures, and these aren't lightweight people, these are very serious, one of two major political talk shows. Like I said, I was just on there filming literally 2 hours ago, and Solovyov was flat out saying we should paint the walls with Estonia. This is major pressures that's starting to build up to respond. And I hope Estonians are listening to this, because you've gone over every single red line there is. There is no more red lines. Estonia has earned whatever fate it gets. And the people support that government. Well, the people that are citizens, that are less than half the population of Estonia, because most of the young in Estonia have left and they don't live in Estonia. I haven't lived within Estonia for years. But the people that are still there are supporting these government entities that are going to bring Estonia to destruction, at least Estonia outside of Narva to destruction. You know, each country chooses its path.
Yeah, when over the past 4 years, or even longer, when people have made the argument that, well, once Russia's done with Ukraine, it will move on to the Baltic states, I pretty much called it out as paranoia. But given these escalations, it's almost bound to spread now, this conflict. But of course, into NATO territory, it's going to be, it's going to be a lot of unknown variables in terms of how the escalation goes from there on. Which kind of takes me to a comment which Lavrov made, but he was, of course, looking towards Iran, where he suggested that many experts believe that we're already within a third world war, given the links between Iran and Russia. I was wondering, well, what do you make of these comments? Do you, how intrinsically linked are these conflicts to begin with?
I think they're going to become very linked, especially if China kicks off in one way or the other. Do these conflicts need to be linked? Should these conflicts even exist? No. The West has done absolutely everything it can to foment these conflicts. has flat out started these conflicts, either indirectly through proxies in Ukraine or directly with an illegal attack and mass murder of civilians in first Iran, now also in Iraq. And before that, I mean, we could just say in Yemen, but that we could count that as a separate conflict. But that's, these conflicts are going to spread. The West is dead set on war. The politicians, except for a few politicians, Austro-Hungarian Empire, formerly, maybe in the future, again, some kind of Austro-Hungarian Confederation. I could see that happening. But outside of those countries, the majority of the Western leaders are psychopaths. They are the Epstein elites. They are dead set, and they don't really give a damn how many of their people die. The only way that they will give a damn is if they are the targets themselves. But they're not counting on that. They're counting on the little people dying, because the little people don't matter. Just less carbon in the world, as they seem to indicate. But they're dead set on it. They have done everything they can to make sure these conflicts spread, to make sure these conflicts grow. Again, you know, going back to the pre-Baltics, Russia tolerated a lot out of these people. You know how many terrorists plots have gone through Estonia trying to smuggle in explosives and icons. Just recently through Poland came a truck with boot insoles with 1.5 grams of explosives in each. These are electric boot insoles to warm feet to go to both the military and refugees that are in cold areas. I mean, it's just constant terrorism that's going across the borders, constant terrorism that has been sponsored by these people. You know, sooner or later, the patience runs out, no matter how patient Moscow has been. And I think the patience in Moscow has actually spurred these people on to do more insane, probably sooner now than later, because it's been going, the spring's being compressed so hard. The response is going to be extremely vicious. The response is going to be extremely bloody. There's a reason they say, you know, there's two sayings about Russians. Yeah, Ivan is slow to get on his feet, but when he gets on his feet, blood flows. That's one.
Well,
Glenn, are you there? Okay.
Yes. Sorry, you froze there for a bit. Yeah.
And the other one is, yeah. And the other one is, you know, Russians are slow to get on the saddle, but once they're in on the saddle, they gallop very fast. And this is what we're getting to right now. They mistake unwillingness on the part of Russia to expand the war as weakness. And sooner or later, that unwillingness finally just goes away. And then they suffer. And then they whine. Oh, why is us? Why and why us? They seem to ignore everything that they do before that. The same thing you hear from the Israelis when they get hit. How, why are we getting hit? From the Ukrainians who for 8 years murdered Russians and have continued to murder Russians in the Donbass. And not only that, why us? Well, you know, it's cry bullying. It's a new term, good term, is cry bullying. They bully around until they get smacked and they cry victim. But that's what we're seeing. Fortunately, that's what we're seeing.
Yeah, you and I spoke about that earlier. There seems to be a different approach to escalation on each side. That is, the NATO mm-hmm. likes to do this very small salami tactic, gradual escalations, while Russia tends to hold on and just go for massive responses, which often, yeah, on the NATO side, results in miscalculation or even delusion about this escalation dominance, the extent to which they're able to bring up or down the tensions. However, as the Ukraine war, though, it resulted also in this in the West cutting itself off increasingly from Russian energy. This has put quite a shock into the international energy markets and the economy. But it seems to be nothing compared to what is coming now, given the war in the Middle East. How are you seeing this? Because even if the war would end today, which it wouldn't, it seems like the repercussions of all the energy disruptions and all the disruptions to fertilizers is something that's going to stick with us for quite some time.
Yeah, I'm not just a pretty war face. I've actually done supply chain management. As a director of supply chain management, I was in Cameron and Halliburton, Halliburton, I was the regional director, supply chain manager for Eurasia. And that's wellheads, that's infrastructure, is drilling, it's above ground infrastructure from the two. And then I was also director of supply chain on construction projects for Technomont, where we were expanding a new portion of the Moscow refinery to make E95 petro, and building one of three phases of a 15 billion euro project on the gas, on the LNG plant in Amur. I think this is Lukoil's biggest, I'm sorry, Gazprom Neft's biggest LNG project or plant anywhere. So I know the time that it takes to order metal constructions for the girders and different designs, the vessels, you know, just for expanding the process in the refinery. It's a very big refinery to make the E95 gas, or not gasoline or petro. You're at about 120 vessels. Now, most of those vessels were 1 to 3 meters long, but we had a couple that were 78 meters long. I mean, these are giant constructions. We use 78 meter long vessel. Just getting there, the logistics is a pain. We literally had to lift a couple buildings with big cranes to get the truck. By the way, it's even longer because there's a truck added to it to get these constructions moved, and it's all by hand. And you see how long it takes just to get that in place. And by the way, they're not only just off the design; they're these giant pipes that have the different flanges added onto them, and different other sections added onto them. It's all done by hand. Then it has to be tested, which means you put it under pressure with water. Then it has to be dried. Then it has to be delivered. Then it has to be tested again with water, and again dried. Then eventually lifted up into place. I mean, 78 meters long. You can understand how big this is. It's almost a football pitch in length, especially when you add the trucks onto it. This is our operation that took about 7 months, 8 months to make. Now, why am I saying this? Because I'm looking at the pictures of the damage from the missiles and the missile strikes just on the Qatari refinery. And I guarantee you, not only do you have to clear out the damaged sections, which are the only thing you can do once one of these vessels are punctured, you can't just weld them shut. They're no longer going to hold that pressure. So they go to scrap metal. You clean it and you take in the scrap metal. You have to make new ones. Again, to order. Each one is made to order. They're not mass produced. Valves can be mass produced to a degree. They are mass produced, both for projects and on shelf for sales. But nobody ever figures, scope of production that, oh, we're going to have to rebuild a dozen refineries all at once, rebuild all this other stuff. No, nobody makes that many kind of valves. That's something else that just obviously is not going to be in any kind of stock to be able to handle. So you have to produce just to get steel, just to understand, just to get steel out of a steel mill on order is usually at about a month and a half process of waiting to get steel out of that's been either in forged into big steel ingots that are then going to be cut up and used for production. Especially if you're doing specialty alloy steels, it'll take even longer because they run in smaller batches. This is everything that you should consider. And when you consider on top of that, who's going to be able to produce this type of equipment? There's only three nations that can produce it in volume. That's Russia, China, and the U.S. To a smaller volume, and sometimes a much smaller volume, you'll have India and Brazil, and minuscule amounts in some other countries. Europe is out of this picture totally. And I'll tell you why. Because A, Europe cannot produce steel cheaply. And right now, Europe can't produce steel, period, because it takes gas. Europe has no more gas. Here's the quick point. They've lost. There's no matter what you pay, there's literally 20% less, 25% less natural gas on the market, period. And when people think, you know, what Trump says or something like drill, baby, drill. Yeah, you're right. You should drill more. But here's the kicker. To bring an oil field or a gas field to to economic exploitation takes 3 to 5 years. From the day you start drilling your first wildcat well to figure out where exactly the deposit is, to the point where you have enough piping and everything done that you can actually export the product on a consistent basis, is 3 to 5 years. Also depending where the fields are located and other issues like that. But yeah, on average, the crisis is here. And the crisis is not coming. The crisis is here. The second wave of the tidal wave is coming. That's starvation. That's collapse of society through starvation. That's coming. That's coming right down by around midsummer when prices for food are going to skyrocket, if not earlier. Right now, it's fuel. But I mean, but look what we're looking at. You know, just begin with the fuel side. It's planting season right now in Southern Europe. In 2 weeks, it'll be planting season in Northern Europe. Maybe 3 weeks if it's suddenly a cold front. But either way, it's April's right here. You know, this is April already coming. What do you need for planting season besides fertilizer? I'm not even going on fertilizer. You need lots of diesel. When you've got 100 acres, you're not going to take your cow or your bull and you're not going to go plow 100 acres. That's a huge amount of land. Small family farms could plow land, a dozen acres, some of that. You've got hundreds of acres, so the bigger farm, you physically can't do it. You need tractors. That's how we've got the modern agriculture. You don't have enough people on the farms. You don't have enough farm animals. You don't have enough plows, those types of plows, if you can find those kinds of plows still. So what do you need? You need diesel. You need relatively cheap diesel in large abundance, which is why Russia, by the way, has a ban on exporting diesel until the end of the planting season, somewhere around May, mid-May. And it probably lasts longer than that, considering the circumstances of the world. So right off the bat, you can't plant as much as you want if you don't have diesel. Sorry, but it doesn't work that way. And then we get to the fact of the fertilizer. Russia produces 40% of the world's chemical fertilizer. Qatar produced 30% of the world's chemical fertilizer. Guess what Europe doesn't produce on that a single ounce of? Because gas is too expensive. Potash is too expensive. Europe no longer produces fertilizer. In fact, America doesn't produce enough fertilizer. America last year bought $500 million, about $560 million worth of Russian fertilizer. This year, probably closer to $1 billion, all things considered, because the market's much tighter. Europe's not going to be getting that. One, because Europe lost Qatar, and two, because Europe cut itself off from Russia, and three, because Russia, by the way, is not that interested in Europe and doing any business with Europe to begin with. The very countries that are pumping equipment and money and psycho mercenaries into Ukraine to kill Russia, the very people whose politicians nonstop talk about Russia is evil and we have to destroy Russia. Well, Russia hears that. Except now you're looking at an absolute crisis. Food, you know, a friend of mine, he's a political professor of politics in Northern Italy. And, you know, 4 months ago, I was talking to him and he's telling me the lower class families in Italy, they can't afford to feed themselves on week four. The money's run out. They don't know. They struggle to feed themselves and their families by week four. Now, what happens when the food prices skyrocket? You get class starvation. It may be not a whole nation starving, but the lower classes, the lower middle classes start to starve, literally starve, not just skip meals. But this is a point where, you know, literal starvation. And on top of that, behind that, it's going to be the third wave, and that's called winter. And there's a good Russian saying, "Зимня за горами," winter's not beyond the mountains. You know, winter's always across. You know, winter's always on your mind. Spring comes in there, you're getting ready for winter. And when that winter comes and there's no gas, because this is going to be something that's going to last a year and a half to 2 years, in my opinion, just to get the Qatari gas fields up. Oh, and that, by the way, I'm sorry, I've got this tirade I'm pouring out. When I was talking infrastructure plus steel constructions to hang all this on, that's not even talking about wellheads. If the wellheads are damaged, now you have the wellhead above, you have the Christmas tree or the fountain, depending where you're at, how it's called, that can still be replaced, but that's still, the valves are produced and the subcomponents are produced oftentimes in more massive quantities But it's individually designed for that. But okay, you could replace those. But if the well itself is damaged, you know, if there's pipe that's been broken or pieces have gone down the well, they have to be fished out, usually using magnets, or you burr into them and grab them and pull them out. Then you have to put new pipe in. You have to cement that pipe in. That all takes time. If the well head is, if the well is seriously damaged, you cap the well and you have to drill a new well. And now we're talking additional months upon months to get all of this done, depending on how widespread the damage is. So quite literally, because I only have the satellite photos and the high altitude drone photos to go off and the videos of the fires, in my opinion, that's a 1.5 to 2 year delay before anything goes up. And then there's question of how much damage has been done to the fertilizer production out of that, because a lot of times, by the way, they take ammonia out of the gas that comes up with the natural gas. But there's another step to this. That's the human step. You have to get workers in. You have to get high quality skilled workers, engineers. A lot of those people aren't going to come back because they don't want to go back into a possible war zone. Then there's the problem. If the desalination plants are destroyed, they physically aren't going to come back because they can't survive in that environment without water. And that whole area lives off of those desalination plants. Qatar and Bahrain, almost 100% of the drinking water comes from desalination plants. You start to see that this process, it's got a lot of moving parts, and all of them are now out of whack. So this could be a very long-term issue that could last into multiple years, if not, you know, a 5-6 year problem. And then there's another point to consider, and I don't know, we'll live and see how this goes. You got to consider that a lot of these artificial Gulf, Southern Gulf countries, Arabic Gulf countries, they're more akin to a corporation run by one single family than to actual nations of any kind. So the question now becomes for these sheikhs, they've got their trillions out of this, but now they're going to need those trillions to rebuild everything. I mean, we're talking massive investments of money. Clearing up, rebuilding, depending on how much damage, of course. This could be 3, 4, 5 years of investment with no money coming in because there's no gas or there's no oil going out. Are they going to do this, or are they going to cut bait and run and sit in whatever country they're in right now with their trillions or billions that they've pulled out of these holdings that they have and just forget about those countries, pseudo-countries? So, you know, there's a lot of factors at play. And the fact that the damage is not over, you know, we don't know where this conflict is going to go next. If the Americans this weekend or begin next week strike the infrastructure, the energy infrastructure in Iran the way Trump was threatening, it could be about a decade before anything gets rebuilt, fully rebuilt and up and running. I mean, these are oil fields and gas fields and infrastructure that took 30, 40 years to get to the point where it's at right now. Sometimes longer, it could all be destroyed in a very short period of time.
Yeah, well, when you refer to the Gulf states,
when
you refer to the Gulf states as you know, corporations masquerading as nations, it's not an exaggeration. If you look at countries like Qatar, I think it's only 10 to 15% of the population are Qataris. The last 85 to 90% are just foreigners. So it's just oil in a desert. And they build up real estate around it, they build up the energy markets. And the problem is, if things start to go south, because the people themselves would leave, it makes everything very difficult. And so it's not even just the technical issues which you refer to, but if the goal now of Iran is to expel the American bases, and if the Gulf states are unwilling to decouple from the US, then they will essentially go after the survivability of these states. As you said, there's many ways. Attack a desalination plant and there's no more water. Again, it's a desert. If the workers begin to flee, then the whole country shuts down. It just seems that how much of the global economy depends on these corporate states, it's quite incredible. So but it kind of begs the question as well, though, how do you see NATO, or sorry, Russia linking itself into Iran here? Because I guess the question on many people's mind would be, after, you know, having spent the past years of NATO being using Ukraine as a proxy against Russia, it seems as if Russia could end up in a similar position. That is, if it hands over some missiles, I'm not sure if Iran needs it, or targeting data. Do you see the possibility of moving this direction, or does it depend on the extent to which the Europeans get involved in the Iran war?
Look, Russia's already there. I mean, let's talk realistically. This isn't a question of whether Russia will give targeting information. It is giving target information. So is China giving target information. And China is now becoming, what you just said doesn't apply to Russia, because Russia was already there from day one. The Chinese now are starting to look at, the Chinese, they're mercantilist. I mean, they always were. They're not a military culture. They never were. They're more of a trader culture. They like to trade. They're not big on military conquest. They've been conquered many times, and they just assimilated those people and continued business as usual. But now they're looking and going, I think the Iranians are going to win. And success breeds success. And now they're going, well, you know, we could invest. Maybe we could push this forward. Russia's been there from day one. I mean, there was complaints coming in from the second day on Iranian drones, where they opened them up and it's Russian chips powering the computers on these drones, with Cyrillic written in there, the name of the companies, everything. Russia, they're Russian. I mean, okay, I'm not going to say this straight out one way or the other, but it takes a year and a half to train a MiG-29 or a Su-35 fighter pilot. Not 4 months, not 5 months. It takes a year to train up an officer to be able to control and command the S-400 control command block. Not 3-4 months. So right off the bat, you can make your own conclusions. These things are being operated. Everybody's smart enough. I think they can make the conclusions that they need to make. There's Russia supplied Iran with a lot of upgrades in equipment over these 6 months that made their systems much more lethal. Avionics, propulsion, targeting, heads-up displays for legacy aircraft. They put in jamming systems, modern jamming systems. We've seen, and these are all field-tested variants. I mean, Russian missiles have heat flares on them. If you ever look at it, Russian ballistic and cruise missiles have heat flares like an airplane. So whenever the Ukrainians are trying to shoot them down, they just start shooting off heat flares as they're flying. It's a nice, interesting little sight to see. The first time I saw it, I was like, oh, that's an interesting advance. The Garand 3s are basically, Zelensky is complaining. Apparently, Russia's production is big enough that they can afford to ship them to Iran. Israel hit the Caspian Sea, where Russia gave it a very stern warning not to try to get in there. Otherwise, there'll be bad consequences for the Israelis, because now they're messing with the Russian-Iranian trade, and a good chunk of that trade goes without transponder signals. you can put two and two together to figure that one out. So Russia's already there. Yes, of course, Russia's going to be proxying the U.S. The U.S. has been proxying Russia for 4 years and admitted to it, even though Trump then comes out, oh, it's not our war. Yeah, it is your war. It is now your war, Mr. Trump. Because you have not divorced yourself from Biden's war for the last year and a half. So it is your war now. Where it goes from here, I don't know. But Russia and Iran, I mean, for Russia, the fall of Iran is a existential crisis, just a bit less than Ukraine. Because if Iran falls, it opens up Central Asia and the Caucasus to import of NATO and U.S. Destabilization, Islamic jihadists, and so on and so on. And then that threatens directly Russia's borders and Russia's integrity, special law on the Kazakhstani border, which is 3,000 kilometers long. And there's no way in hell Russia's going to tolerate that. Sorry, we'll fight to the last Iranian and Russian while we're at it, and the U.S. is not going to win there. In fact, everybody's waiting for the U.S. now to put ground forces in for the massacre to begin. I mean, the Iranians are flat out said. There was an interview with, I can never remember the guy's name, the foreign minister of Iran. I don't know if you remember his name. I always forget his name.
Yeah, Charia. Oh, I forgot. Oh, it's...
Yeah, I see his face, but I'm horrible with names. So no offense to anybody in Iran. And they said, aren't you worried about how the Americans are coming? They're going to do ground forces? Like, we're waiting for them. I mean, this is quite literally that. We're waiting for them. Please come in. So we can start destroying you with our hands. You know, this... Well, not quite literally with their hands, or maybe with their hands, but I mean, they're prepared. They're waiting. It's a fortress. Iran is it's the biggest fortress in the world. And just look at the map of it. Look at relief map of it. If you don't understand that this is a massive fortress that the U.S. military is absolutely incapable of taking, maybe a few islands and then being plugged by drones and missiles nonstop day and night while casualties mount. Sure, they could do that. But anything significant? Oh, we're going to march to Tehran. Really? Have you looked at a map where Tehran is located? How many kilometers of mountains you're going to plan on marching through? Good luck there. You know, this isn't a Hollywood movie. This is real life. And that's just the point. First of all, the logistics strain would be extreme. And the U.S. just physically does not have the capability of doing it. It is not a land power. It is a sea and air power. It is not a land power. The U.S. Army plus Marines is about 550,000 men, but that's not combat troops. There's maybe about 120,000 combat troops, and that's counting the National Guard, pulling the reserves. The rest is what we call ash and trash. It's combat support, which would be intelligence and engineers and military police, and combat service support, which is everything else that 100 years ago or 120 years ago wasn't considered part of the army, but is now. The Teamsters, the mechanics, the cooks, the finance guys, the medics. You know, if you look at history books, what changed was, if you look at history books and it said, you know, so-and-so brought an army of 100,000 men, you figure these are all either pikemen or spearmen or swordsmen, whatever, infantry of some kind, or musketeers. Cavalry and artillery or catapults, whatever, depends the decade you're, or the century you're looking at. But they were all combat soldiers. But now what we're calling as an army is not all combat soldiers, because each one of these armies came with a long train of civilians, what they were called civilians or contracted civilians. Those were the people bringing in the supplies, fixing the damaged armor or fixing the damaged musket or rifle. What have you, because the armies always travel with this big train. By the way, the prostitutes came in there and their wives came in there to wash their clothes. I mean, this whole human train that came, Napoleon came with the same thing into Moscow. Behind his army came a giant train of humanity that did all the jobs that needed to keep that army in the field. Now it's all considered, it's all called part of the military. It's military jobs. But again, they're soldiers, but they're not combat soldiers. They have minimal, if any, training to do any combat. They go to range once or twice, maybe once or twice practice bayonet tactics, once or twice practice some basic infantry skills. They don't remember it. They're not good at it. They're not made for that. But this is all part of the U.S. Army. So when they say, oh, we have 500,000 men, no, you don't. You've got 100, 120,000 you can throw into this meat grinder. There's over 1.5 million of Iranians waiting for revenge on home turf. And these are actual combat soldiers. They have the rest of society right behind their back to do all the other jobs that need to be done. I mean, you're outnumbered 10 to 1. They're on the defensive and they're in mountains in prepared defensive positions. I mean, that's a suicide mission. And for the U.S. to start, recruitment it's called, good Lord, what is it called? Just flew out of my head. It's called every man at 18 has to sign up selective service. That's it for selective service. I mean, I had to sign selective service, register with it. And what I've been told by people in the know is it's in such bad condition. It's going to take 4 or 5 months just to get it all organized. It's computerized, organized, and then start calling people in. And then, you know, you have to prepare these people. You start getting people in, you have to prepare for it. But then you get to the fact that 40% of Americans are obese. 30% of Americans are fat, but not morbidly obese. And the 30% that's left doesn't mean that they're all physically fit. It's just that their weight category isn't going into fat. You can deal with some of the fat and run it off, but that, by the way, takes more time. The U.S. Army last year in 2025 had an obesity rate, the U.S. military, I won't just say the Army, the U.S. military had an obesity rate of somewhere around 22-23%. When I served, I left in middle of 2004, in July of 2004, 18th July 2004, to be more exact, there wasn't a 1% obesity rate. It wasn't tolerated. But now when your recruitment is down so much as it is because you've sent people 6-7 rotations or 6-7 years into Iraq, into Afghanistan, and a place like that, you've used your human material up, and that human material went home and said, don't join the military. It's not worth it. You can't get enough people, so you start dropping the standards. And they drop and drop and drop, and now you have an obesity rate of 23%, 22-23%. It's insane. So every fourth soldier, if he runs 10 meters, he may collapse from a heart attack. I mean, you look at some of these people. When Trump called up the National Guard out of Texas, it became amply problem because they were all fat. And these were infantrymen. And they were coming out, and they're like this big. And you're looking at us, what the hell is he going to do except suck up bullets if something goes sour? He's a big target. He's not combat capable. You look at these guys, seriously? The only thing they're combat capable of is taking out an all-you-can-eat food bar. I may say mean things, but this is the reality of combat. Combat is mean. It's as mean a thing as a human being could do to another human being, is to open up their guts or blast their head open. But that's what it is. And it is quite literally, if you're not fit, you don't survive. You may not survive even if you're fit. If there's a massive amount of chance, whether that piece of shrapnel comes flying through your head or takes out your buddy's head or just misses you both. But if you're not fit enough to be able to sustain that kind of pressure, just die off. That's what it is. That's the reality of it. And this has been the U.S. military at this point. I mean, just to be absolutely brutally honest with it. And this is the military that Trump, by the way, and not a single general says anything counter because they all want their career afterwards. None of them will ever be held irresponsible. They want their million-dollar careers after their generalships are done when they retire. And these are the people that Trump wants to throw into combat against people that want revenge for their dead women and children, are fighting on their turf, and are a civilization that's lasted 5,000 years.
Well, I think when you call it Iran a fortress, I think that's a very good description, because people often forget that the country is almost four times the size of Iraq. It's pure mountains and again, populated by 90 million people, and then you have the sea on the outside, just, you know, to make it more difficult to storm the walls. So it's, I think that's why the Foreign Minister Araghchi was making this point that, yes, please do send your troops. You know, the closer they come, the easier it will be to take them out. But as the U.S. is sending, a few thousand troops, it begs therefore the question, what exactly are they good for? And Karg Island, it seems too problematic, too difficult, unless they're sent over from Saudi Arabia. But even then, they're sitting ducks. But I was thinking that if Trump really wants to open up the Strait of Hormuz and gamble a lot on this, you also have these islands, especially three islands near the Strait of Hormuz. It's Abu Musa, and then you have the Greater and Lesser Tumb Islands. It's interesting because they're claimed by United Arab Emirates ever since Iran took them in 1971. So, and suddenly now we see the UAE saying, "Oh, we might step up in the fight against Iran." Given that they're so, with what army, but where does this enthusiasm come from? It seems that this might be a trade-off if the Americans are promising them these islands back. U.S. gets control over the Strait of Hormuz, or more control at least, while UAE gets its old islands back. again, speculation, but what do you see otherwise? What can a few thousand boots on the ground achieve here?
Well, no, I think it will go after these small islands, but here's the problem, or the coastline in the northern coastline in Iran, which in a lot of places is relatively flat, but it runs into mountains not too far up. The problem is, whether you're on the islands or the coastline, what's the width of the entire, at the narrowest point, what's the width? 36 kilometers. You know what goes 50 kilometers? Especially if you have a retranslator drone sitting up there, the FPV drone. You can take an FPV drone with a big battery pack that can carry up to 20 kilograms of explosives. In other words, a couple of RPG rounds strapped to it. And you can go hunting Americans or UAE soldiers on those islands. And you can do this day in and day out. And especially those islands aren't 36 kilometers wide. You can take out any ships going through. First of all, because around the tip, the dredged canal, because these waters are not deep. These supertankers cannot go through these waters without beaching themselves. The dredged canal, which, by the way, has to be maintained and has to be dredged. I'm not quite sure how often they do it, but you got to consider that. But that dredged canal is 2,700 meters wide, right down the middle. It's about 18 kilometers in, right down the middle at the nearest point. Yeah, and believe you me, a supertanker is a gigantic target. You put one or two of those out of commission in the middle of that, they got to be dredged out of there because nothing else is going to pass. I'm not sure whether an American destroyer can pass into the shallower waters or not. I'm not quite sure how shallow is water, but the supertankers can't. So right off the bat, you can easily close the gate, those gates that way. But those islands in the north, they're all within 15, 16 kilometers of the mainland or less. They're all within FPV drone range. You could set up 200-300 teenagers who've lost their families or lost their brothers and sisters and want revenge. Here's VR goggles, do a quick course on how to learn to power and control. Half of them probably already know how to control these drones. And here's a pair of VR goggles and a dozen drones. Go play Hunt the Americans or Hunt the UAE. And it becomes one big game, and they could be under every tree, under rock, trying to find these guys. They're all separated out, maybe teams of two. Usually they run in teams of two. But that's the point is, you're talking, an investment of 400 or 500 people, and you could have 3,000 or 4,000 drones flying down, or a couple of drones for every Marine that landed on there. How do you get the wounded off? How do you supply them? And here's the other thing, MI6, because, it wasn't the Ukrainians, I'll call it what it is. MI6 attacked a Russian, a shadow fleet, if you want to, I don't consider them shadow fleet, a non-Lloyds of London insured ship off the coast of one of the Aegean islands. Using what? And this was, about 3 or 4 months ago? And they did it using what? They used FPV drones with RPG rounds attached to them, and they swarmed in there, and they hit, and they damaged, and they set it on fire. Yeah, that could be used on any ship. No American ship will survive 100 drones flying in a wave. It's done. They will get through. At least you don't need that many to get through, especially with that much explosive power behind every single drone. And once it's damaged enough and burning, what do you do when that Aegis destroyer is on fire with a crew of 350 people? This is something that can cascade very quickly. So will they get used? Probably that's where they will get used. Will it be a suicide mission? It'll be just as much of a cluster as if they went after Kark, maybe even worse. And the Iranians are going to be within easy shooting range with everything they have to just keep lobbing into those islands. It's even easier to shoot those islands than Kark Island because they're much closer to the mountains and the mainland. So there is no good solution for Trump on land. There's only massive failure and casualties and a cluster and less massive. And the best thing is not to do it at all. More than likely, he's going to do it. That's what my opinion now is. I was hoping not, but he seems dead set on it because he doesn't know how to get out. And his only theory on how to get out of this is to double down and triple down and quadruple down. And do stupid down. Mr. Win Bigley, because he wins bigly. That's what his own words. He wins so big, he wins bigly. Mr. Win Bigly is gonna make gonna send a lot of men to their deaths. Gonna leave a lot of orphan children and widows behind, and parents without their sons and daughters, because the moron cannot break and just take the punishment that he's got for doing something stupid like starting this war. Instead, he's gonna just expand it. Unfortunately, I'd like things to be differently, to go differently. Yeah, but that's what I think we're facing, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's the problem with him trying now to fix the narrative by overselling the successes in this war. There's no, it makes so much more difficult to walk this one back and accept something less than a victory. So,
well, Glenn, there was a story that came out from an inside source just recently came out that said Trump's war briefings. Pardon my French. I shit you not when I say this. It's a crude saying, but I think it's very effective for this. First, a little bit of a background. I remember Tulsi Gabbard was talking about, we had to reform the daily security brief for Trump from having, the standard is here's 5-6 pages of information. Please read it, Mr. President. Trump doesn't like to read. So they had to reform the national security or the international security brief down to something that looked like a Fox News break, just little pieces instead of so Trump doesn't have to read something that covers like 15 minutes of watching. Well, having said that, and this is Tulsi admitted to this back about a year ago. Well, what the insider's saying is, Trump's war briefs are about 3 minutes long, and it's strike videos. U.S. Army or Navy or Air Force blowing stuff up. Nothing negative, no reality. I mean, what are you going to take out of an entire day worth of war in a flexible environment in 3 minutes? We're dealing with a very shallow human being who is not well-educated, no matter if he finished Ivy League schools. My God, his own mother, there was an interview with her when he was young, obviously. And what she said was, I know my son is an idiot and he's awkward socially, but he's my son and God help me, I love him. And please, and if he goes into politics, it'll be a total disaster. That's a quote from his mother in an interview in the New York Times back about 40 years ago or so. But his mother knew him best, obviously. And I've heard this from other people that have known Trump closely, very closely, including being in his entourage in the 90s when they were doing party drugs every couple of days and staying up all night and doing these wild parties in Atlantic City in New York. I've talked to these people. I'm friends with one of them. That was a former Navy SEAL who was in Trump's entourage. So, and they all say the same thing. He's not a deep person. He's a great marketing person, which is what this is the fault. This is why all republics die. Democracy is mob rule, but republics all die for the same reasons. It's marketing. It's a feel good popularity contest on elections. You don't get the best people. It's human nature. You get the guy that sells himself better than the other guy. That he may not be. He may be as dense as a brick, while the other guy's a genius that'll save you. Nah, but he's not as popular. It's a popularity contest. And then Trump won the popularity contest. He is a marketing guru. It doesn't go much deeper than that, though. And once you get into the White House or into the Kremlin or wherever you're in, whatever place you're in, now you have to start working. And if all that person has, in this case, Trump and a lot of the EU leaders, we see the same thing, is they can campaign well, they can sell themselves well, but there's nothing behind them, no knowledge base, no sternness, no concept of where they want to go. You get the message you get.
Well, his briefing consists of videos showing explosions. It could explain his confidence. So why things are going better than it is. Anyways, thank you so much for taking the time.